and Adam. So I wanted to dedicate the learning tonight to his memory. So with that in mind, I want to say that it's wonderful to see everybody, and to pick up where we left off. So we left off in, you can't blame it on me. It's not a good story. We didn't leave off in such a good place. So David had sent the scroll. This is a particularly ghoulish detail in an altogether awful story. So, David sends Uriah back to the front with a sealed diplomatic pouch, which has his own death warrant in it, right? And he says to Yoav that, bring Uriah at the head of a commando group where they're going to go to the most dangerous part of the battlefield. Of course, Uriah's fate will be sealed. So last week we spoke about different approaches, ranging from the approach of the Talmud in Masechta Shabbos, which says that on technical grounds, one could theoretically exonerate David from some of the most serious charges of adultery and maybe even the murder charge. Abravanel, on the other hand, said he was guilty of all of the above and worse. And the Malbim says that, yeah, we think we can exonerate him on the technical charges because of these either conditional or absolute divorce bills that were generated prior to the onset of battle. But there are other elements that you have to look at as well. The fact that the Jewish people are at war and David HaMelech is at home, so that's a problem simply from the standpoint of leadership. So I tried to suggest maybe a fourth approach last week, which is that what this is really about is sin as self-betrayal. There are so many things that we admire about David. And everything about this story is David sort of, right, turning his back on himself. So let's begin with the point that the Malbim raises, the idea of not being out in front of the Jewish people in battle, right, and sort of hanging out at home and, relaxing and maybe, having a good time. So we know that David HaMelech burst onto the scene in the battle against Goliath. And maybe somebody here remembers from our studies last year that when David bursts onto the scene in the battle against Goliath, right, he wasn't technically meant to be at war, right? He was considered too young for conscription, and his older brothers get really angry at him, and they start chastising him and say, what are you doing here? But David feels like he needs to, once he sees what's going on, that there's this giant who's cursing the Jewish people and the Jewish army, so David feels that he has to be involved. How can I sit it out? Right? So, that's David bursting onto the scene with this sense of how could I possibly not participate in a battle along with the people of Israel? And now he's the king, right? One of the main functions of the king was to lead the Jewish people in war. Asher yetzei lifnehem, v'asher yavo lifnehem, v'asher yotzeim, v'asher yevieim. And here we have David HaMelech sitting it out. So that's number one. Number two is David had this great respect for the Jewish army. And we talked about before how when Goliath was cursing the Jewish army, David was like outraged. You can't say that about the army of Hashem, about Tzivos Hashem. And here, David is using the Jewish army as an instrument to carry out what is completely inappropriate, right? It's one thing if the king wants somebody put to death, even if it's legitimate, because he's Mori B'Malchus, but you don't use the army in a surreptitious fashion. So it's a debasement of the army of Israel, Vaya Machanecha Kadosh, it's called in Israel today, Torah Aneshek, purity of arms. We don't engage in these things. Unfortunately, if there are incidents of excessive violence, inappropriate, they're taken very seriously in Sahel. They have no place there. So the Jewish army has to be a place of Vaya Machanecha Kadosh, so it's certainly an abuse of the Jewish army. Point number two. Number three, right, we know how much respect David had for the Aron, right? That was the whole reason he wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. He says, Hinei Anochi Yoshev BeBeis HaRazim, here I am in the palace of the cedar trees, V'Aron HaBris Hashem B'Socha Yiriyah, and the Aron is in the curtain, so to speak. And remember, the Jewish people were at war, and they had the special Aron with them. And it takes Uriah to say to David, you want me to go home and act like everything is normal when the Jewish people are in battle, and the Aron, he specifically mentions, is in the field. So again, that's number three. So I think what we've tried to establish is that in so many different ways, it's a betrayal of who David himself should be, about who David was and all the things generally speaking, that we admire about him. And speaking of admiration, here's another man that we certainly admire, the one and only Siggy Laster, who's joining us. Siggy waves to the crowd, acknowledges his admirers. It's so wonderful to have Siggy with us. So again, what you see here is really David turning, his back on himself. And I brought the example last week, and this is a good place for us to pick up. You remember earlier on in our studies this year when Yoav commits a very treacherous act and he murders Avner in cold blood. Remember, David throws up his arms and says, these B'nai Tsruya, right? Tsruya was David's sister, so Yoav is his nephew. These are very rough folks, and I'm a Rach Vetzayer, I'm a young king, and basically I don't approve of these people, but what do you want me to do about them? I can't control them. So, and now, when David has, let's call it, some bidding to be done, all of a sudden he turns to them as if, that's a normal thing. So you see, David is really compromising his own standards. So that's the approach that I'm going to take throughout over here, is that the story is really a story of David compromising it on himself, compromising his own sense of integrity, and compromising what was so important to him. And that's what I call my terminology here, is the terminology of self-betrayal, that when a person sins, not only betraying God and betraying other people, that's true, but they're really betraying themselves in a very significant way. I think we mentioned it last week, when the Rambam discusses the pathology of sin in general, he says, because, we all have free choice, when a person debases themselves, when a person fails themselves in terms of who they could have been and the reality of what they have become, you can all think about the image from the famous work of literature, the picture of Dorian Gray, where, he looks good on the outside, but that picture in the attic, which keeps on, showing somebody who's more and more decrepit. So, unfortunately, we have a situation here where David is failing himself. So with that, let's pick it up with a narrative. Today will probably be a little bit shorter because we laid out the groundwork, but I at least want to, get the basic facts across in terms of the crime itself. So here we go. We have Yoav receiving the document. And the Navi testifies to the following. So Yoav made sure to organize things that Uriah would be placed in a location on the field of battle where he would be particularly vulnerable. So the Malbim has a very fascinating explanation of all of this. But basically what he says is that in the ancient world, when there was siege warfare, so every now and again, raiding parties would be sent out of the city to sort of probe. So Vayitzu Anshei Ha'ir from Amon, Vayilachamu Es Yoav, so this was a normal thing, and the people who were literally in that part of the line, of the siege line, so there were casualties. Vayipol Mina Ame Avdei David, Vayamos Gam Uriah Hachiti, and Uriah dies, as was planned, right? So in terms of execution of the plan, right, you give an A. In terms of the morality of the plan, right, we don't have a grading system for that. It's worse than an F. So Vayishlach Yoav Vayagela David is called Divrei HaMilchama. So Yoav sends to David and explains, everything that happened. Vayitzavis HaMalach Lemor, he's going to send the messenger back. And he says, Kilchaluscha is called Divrei HaMilchama L'daber L'melech, when you finish with the what they call the after-action report, right? That's the military parlance. When you finish giving the after-action report, Ladaber Lamelech, the king might be very disappointed. We haven't taken the city yet. After all, we've sustained casualties. V'hayoyim talach hamas hamelech. So if the king will be very angry, V'hamar lecha madua nigashtim el ha'ir li lachem, and he'll be very, very, very upset, about us taking these risks, that you put yourselves in a vulnerable position because they can shoot down on you from on top of the walls. Right, you were very vulnerable there. This is a reference to a story in Shoftim when an evil man named Avimelech was killed by a woman. He got very close to a tower where some of his would-be victims were hiding, and a woman dropped a stone on his head, killing him. Vayamos betevet, lama nigashtem el hachoma, so Yoav is preempting, and he's saying David is going to be very angry. He's going to say, our tactics are reckless. Vayamarta, at that point, you should tell him, O king, I have some more bad news for you, quote-unquote. Gam avdecha Uriah hachiti meis. You have to say, I have some bad news that one of the leading soldiers, Uriah hachiti, was known as a leading warrior, so he died as well. Now again, the malach, the messenger, is none the wiser. He doesn't know anything about what's going on, so he thinks that, you know, yet another piece of bad news that I have to deliver. He probably wants to be transferred to a different unit, right? No, he doesn't want to be in the news-bearing unit anymore. He wants to, I don't know, join the cooking staff. But be that as it may, of course, Yoav knows that if David is going to hear this, so at least it'll give him one piece of good news. See, Yoav and David are in on the message. Of course, the messenger himself is not. So Vayilech Hamalach Vayavo Vayagei LeDavid Is Kol Asher Shlacho Yoav Vayomer Hamalach Al David. So the messenger says to David, you can see here that he's not in on it. Ki Gavru Aleinu Anashim. He's giving the bad news. Vayitzi Aleinu Asadeh, and they surprised us by coming out of the city. V'niya Aleihem Ad Pesach Hashar. We actually were able to fight back, and we chased them back into the city. But then, of course, they had the advantage from on top of the city walls. So he just throws it all. He lumps it all in together. And then, unfortunately, there were more casualties, and Uriah Hachiti died as well. Because from his point of view, it doesn't make any sense. He's going to say all the bad news, then David's going to say, all right, and then he's going to say, oh, king, one more piece of bad news. So he thinks that's a crazy plan. So he says to David, everything at once, right? Which just goes to show you that he wasn't in on it. But of course, Yoav had in mind that David HaMelech would at least be comforted by the one piece of good news, which is that Uriah, from David's standpoint, died. So David's reaction is very telling. Vayomer David al HaMelech, Ko tamar al Yoav, al yirah b'necha sadavar hazeh, don't let it be discourage you. Ki chazo v'chazeh tochal hacharev, this is just the nature of war. Hachazek milcham techas, you should be strengthened el ha'ir, v'harsa v'chazkehu. Twice David says, you know, you'll be strengthened, don't let it get you down, this is just the natural course of war. So we know this is anything but the natural course of war. This was a conspiracy. They made a conspiracy to have an innocent man, unless, again, what goes in the direction of the Gemara in Masechta Shabbos, that he was a Morid B'Malchus because he didn't follow David's instructions, but to have an otherwise innocent man killed in the field of battle, this is not Kazov v'chazeh tochal hacharev. So again, it's just heaping, the cover-up is worse than the crime here. Heaping even worse things, and the crime is pretty bad. But heaping even worse debasement. So the Navi concludes the story as follows. Vatishma Eshes Uriah doesn't even use her proper name. It calls her Eshes Uriah, I think, to highlight that she was really, even if you want to make a technical argument, that she was either divorced or conditionally divorced because of the war to avoid the problem of Aguna of becoming a chained woman in case her husband would die and they wouldn't be able to identify him. Vatishma Eshes Uriah, she's not even called Batsheva, just Eshes Uriah, Kimei Suriah, Isha, Vatispod al Baala, and she eulogizes her husband, Vayavor Ha'evel, and as soon as the period of mourning is over, Vayishlach David Vayasfal Beso. Remember, this is one of the Abravanel's charges, indictment against David, is that, he carries on, Vatilo Isha, Vatela Lo Bein, they have a child. Vayira hadavar asher asa David b'nei Hashem, and what David did was terrible in the eyes of Hashem. The Abravanel notes, I'll just read a passage here. V'nei amar ha-kosev, vayira hadavar asher asa David b'nei Hashem, lefi shehaya hadavar asher nistar ma'od. It was well hidden from everybody else. It was hidden because, again, the only one who knew about one aspect of it was Yoav. But in terms of David's relationship with Bathsheba, nobody knew. V'ishal yedav becholayla kiim ha'elokim shu bochin levavos uchlayos ve'enav mishotetos bechol aretz v'chol davar lo nitcha mimenu. You can't hide anything from God. Shera ma sha'asa David v'zeo amaro be'enei Hashem. Hashem saw it. Ratzalomar b'nei Yisrael Lo haya hadava rao maguna. Nobody knew about it. Ki lo hayu yodim amitas hadavar. There was a well-orchestrated cover-up. Aval be'enei Hashem she'akol galoi lefanav haya hadava ra. But in God's eyes, things were really, really awful. So this is the end of the action that took place, and all of the rest of the chapters are going to be basically the aftermath of this behavior. So now let's discuss a little bit. David, again, as we laid out at the beginning, is utilizing so to speak the opportunity of the Jewish people being at war. To solve a problem. What's the problem? The problem is very much of his own making, that Bathsheba is pregnant, and there's not going to be anybody to whom the pregnancy can be attributed, because Uriah had been at the field of battle for such a lengthy period of time. And part of the need to cover up the adulterous relationship, again, going in the direction here of the Abravanel. So David HaMelech commits a very, very serious sin. And he does it in such a way that reflects his ability to use his office, his powerful office, to conceal this crime, this sin. Which brings me to my point of discussion for the evening. There is no doubt that every aspect of this sin was made possible by one thing: David's status as the king. Let us go back to the beginning. Would any person simply have been able to look from the rooftop, identify a woman, and have her brought into the palace? Would any other person have been able to direct Yoav to have a person placed in a particularly vulnerable position in the order of battle? So I think what we must discern within this episode is a textbook and definitional abuse of power. David can only perform these immoral acts because of the enormous power that he wields. David can only perform these acts because of the enormous powers of his office. And when you have immoral acts that are a direct consequence and are only made possible by the office that a person occupies, that represents the very definition of an abuse of that station. There are powers given to the king so that he can be a servant of the people. Up until now, David has done just that. Remember that classic scene where Michal was chastising David for, quote, lowering himself to the level of the people. Ma nichbad hayom melech Yisrael. She mocked him for being amongst the people. When David retorted, Hashem asher bachar bi mikol beis avich, the reason he chose me is precisely for that reason. Nikalos yodis mizos vaisi shafal beinai. I do not lord myself over the people. V'im ha'amahos asher amart imam ikaveda, I will be honored to be amongst the people. Up until now, David has manifested supreme respect for the Jewish people and supreme respect for the office that he occupies as an instrument of service to the people. And so, following my basic premise of self-betrayal, we have yet another piece of this ignominious puzzle. that David is debasing his status as Melech. The power invested in that office exists to care for the people, to provide for them. Let me go through some examples. The Torah prescribes the king in a number of different ways from having excesses. One, he's not allowed to have an excess number of wives. Okay, now by our standards, it doesn't strike us as particularly limiting. It's 18. We don't seem to think that that would be particularly restrictive, but he's certainly not permitted to take an Eshes Ish, a married woman. Number two, a king is not allowed to have an abundance of wealth. V'chasev izahav lo yarbelo me'od. Now, the Gemara immediately points out, lo yarbelo, he can't aggrandize himself. He shouldn't be enriching himself, lining his own pockets. Right? I think Vladimir Putin owns 3/4 of all the wealth in Russia. The rest of it is divided amongst the 130 million people in the country. 90% of that belongs to his two best friends. But v'chasav izahav lo yarbelo me'od, the Gemara says, but he has, of course, enough money to support basic infrastructure and all the needs of government. Of course he needs that. The Torah says he can't have too many horses. Lo yarbelo susim. But the Gemara says, of course, he can have as many as are needed for the common defense, for the national defense. So all of the laws governing the monarchy reflect the idea, a very simple idea, that the office exists for public service, not for enrichment of self, whether it's respect to Nashim, Susim, or Kesef Izahav. And most importantly, on the affirmative side, the Torah demands that the king write an extra Sefer Torah, and unlike the average Jew who is supposed to learn from that Sefer Torah, the king has a separate obligation to carry it around everywhere. Why? So the Torah says, because we're very concerned that power will corrupt a person, the king. Because he cannot become arrogant. He cannot develop a behavioral pattern that reflects any kind of superiority vis-a-vis the people that he is meant to serve. The powers of the office are enormous. But they exist not for him, but for the people. That's why he can have as many horses as the army needs, as much money as the government requires. But not more than that for himself. It's a very clearly defined halachic institution. And David, in this instance, certainly debases that. Livilti rum levavo me'achav. It's not better. That was David's unique understanding. That David came me'achare hatzon, as an afterthought, being a simple shepherd, min hanaveh, from the fields, from the pen. And in this one fell swoop, all of that, which is so authentic. I'm not saying that, you know, it was a facade and but there is this stain on all of that. That's what the story of David and Bathsheba is. And what we'll see as we go forward in the narrative, beginning next week, God willing, with chapter 12, is how this rupture in David's career and in his character, requires almost completely hitting the reset button. I gave the example last week. I'll give it again. It's not that David simply can't continue as the Melech after this. He is deposed by his own son. Eventually, Avshalom, that's part of the punishment for this. And only after that experience can he restart as a Melech. It's very important. His behavior, his abuse of the power, the enormous power invested in his office, requires him to leave that office. And the difference in terms of David being able to then restart is the depth, the profundity, and the sincerity of his tshuva, which itself is a remarkable story. So with that, that concludes what I wanted to share this evening. Like I said, it'd be a little bit shorter. If anybody has any comments, your questions, please do feel free to weigh in. And if not, we will pick it up with the aftermath of David's sin, beginning with the chapter 12, and seeing what happens across the board, how everything will fall apart for David as a wake of this betrayal of himself and betrayal of his role as Melech, as servant of the people.